Okay, we need a comedy routine based on the name of the new Hartford baseball team. So let's brainstorm some funny names we can run with.
Okay, Hartford Yard Goats.
What the f*** is a yard goat?
I know, right?
Wait, got a problem. That's one of the names under serious consideration.
Wait, are you being serious right now?
It's on the list.
Okay, Hartford Blue Frogs.
Right, that sounds funny.
Yeah, it's random, right?
Ugh, it's also on the list.
Okay, how about the Hartford Choppers?
What would that even mean? Wood, teeth, helicopters, motorcycles, Benihana?
Just any kind of, you know, random chopping.
Ugh, this is also on the serious list.
Are you serious? You know what they should really do? Call the team the Hartford Hookers. I mean, come on. The Hartford Hookers.
There's only one problem with that.
What?
You don't see it? The problem with Hartford Hookers?
No, I don't. Not at all.
Thomas Hooker was a proponent of the doctrine of preparationism, which taught that a person seeking conversion might dispose himself toward receiving God's grace.
Too big a departure from the Synod of Dort and its doctrine of unconditional election.
That's what I'm thinking.
You're probably right. Here's a show about how to name a baseball team, how to get in a really bad fight about a painting in a library, and how to make people happy when they get a ticket from a cop. And now, the starting shortstop for the Hartford Fiduciary Pre-Exemptions, Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, there was a time when our minor league baseball team name was based mainly on ERISA law, kind of, a somewhat recherche bit of insurance. You know, you get the idea. Anyway, we are going to be talking about baseball team names. And they're absolutely right, by the way. You cannot name a team after a Puritan divine, even if he is the founder of the city, who so substantially departs from the classic Calvinist doctrines of total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and preservation of the saints. So I would say Hartford Hookers. For that, who would take their kids to a game, you know, named after somebody who is not really a strict Calvinist? All right, so as you probably know, you may even be getting ready to call in. Before I even introduce our guest, let me suggest that you call in. At 860-275-7266. Hartford is about to have a new baseball franchise. The franchise has not been named. And there's a list of names. First of all, the list of semifinalist names will be announced at 3 o'clock today. However, we already have that list, or at least what was that list as of yesterday. And what we want to do really is have not so much a disputatious conversation about how stupid all those names are, although chances are that will happen, but kind of a conversation about how teams get named and what's the difference between a stupid name and a good name and what some of the trends are in naming teams. And so, you know, no matter what kind of conversation we want to have about this, we really felt, oh, by the way, the phone number again, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Whatever conversation we were going to have, we wanted to have it with Chris Kramer. He's the founder of sportslogo.net, and he, in fact, is the guy who got the list of semifinalist names and made it public yesterday. Now, welcome to our show.
Oh, thank you very much.
Before we begin, do you sort of feel like Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, you know, getting the information from Edward Snowden? Do you feel as though, like, maybe your own safety's in jeopardy now? You're going to be strip searched in airports and stuff like that?
Well, I don't know. These minor league baseball executives can be pretty shifty.
Absolutely. So I'll read through the list that you provided yesterday. As you have pointed out, it's possible that in an environment of derision and ridicule, which has been happening on social media, they may tweak this list a little bit by 3 o'clock today. But Hartford Blue Frogs, Hartford Choppers, Hartford Hedgehogs, Hartford Honey Badgers, Hartford Hound Dogs, Hartford Praying Mantis, or perhaps Mantises, Hartford Hartford River Hogs, Hartford Screech Owls, Hartford Whirly Birds, Hartford Yard Goats. All right, well, we can get into the specifics of that. But first of all, I wanted to ask you, it seemed to me that in doing some research for today's show, that there's a very fine line between the name of genius and the name that's really bad. You know, that minor league baseball is a place where you take some more risks. You know, we go back as far as watching Klinger on MASH run around in his Toledo Mudhens uniform, and we know that this is a place where, you know, maybe you are going to have a slightly more colorful, inventive kind of name than you might have at the major league level. But it's sort of you know, the difference between what's really cool and what's really stupid is hard to detect, or at least hard to agree upon. Does that strike you as true?
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, especially as you're saying, in the minor leagues, you certainly do have that extra room for creativity. It seems to be the focus in the minor leagues is to appeal to more of a family-friendly, more of a kid environment. So the direction there is more towards the silly, more towards the cartoony, whereas in the major leagues it's more of a serious, aiming for a traditional name. But as you say, it is a fine line to walk between silly and serious and quality. This list is all full of silly.
Yeah. I mean, the Lansing Lugnuts is either a great name or a really bad name. I would say it's a great name. It fulfills my criteria for a great name. But do you have criteria? Are there certain qualities that separate a good name from a bad name?
Well, just speaking personally, a great name is one that's both marketable, one that appeals to everyone, and also has some sort of tie to the community that it's representing.
Right, and I think that's a problem with some of these names. For example, there is now, in the last 24 hours, since you opened this Pandora's box, which, by the way, is not one of the names, since you opened this Pandora's box, there is a certain ripple of sentiment on behalf of the Hartford Yard Goats. But my problem is the Hartford Yard Goats doesn't meet one of the criteria you just articulated. There's no particular goat geographical connection to Hartford. So, you know, I mean, it seems to me, you know, that if you think of the names that are really good. Now, sometimes the names have a geographical connection that only the people there would understand. For example, the Fort Wayne Tin Caps, a Padres affiliate at the Single-A Midwest League. They are the Tim Caps name I'm reading here was planted in Johnny Appleseed's memory.
Right.
Appleseed wore a cooking pot on his head during his travels, and he's buried in Fort Wayne. And the city holds an annual Johnny Appleseed Festival. But it really isn't intuitive, right? You look at that name and you think, oh, that's why they're the Tin Caps.
And it makes such a great story, and it makes you more interested in learning about their brand and the history behind it.
Do you have any particular favorite names, either within the world? Well, before we even get to that, I mean, there are various trends, right, within names. I mean, one thing that happened, you know, I don't really know exactly when this trend began, but you started to have some names of things that are not only animals, but they're not even plural. They're kind of a collective concept. So you've got the Miami Heat. You've got the Utah Jazz. In minor league baseball, I think you have the Fort Myers Miracle. So that's sort of one thing, sort of the abstract, non-corporeal thing. And then there's another trend that's sort of things that are not things. Like even, I mean, the Hartford things are going to be, they used to be the New Britain Rock Cats. And there really is no such thing as a rock cat. But there's some of that going around, right?
Yeah, creativity is always evolving. It seems lately in the minor leagues, it's to get attention. It's to get sort of, do whatever you can to get mentioned on ESPN, on Keith Olbermann or anything. If that requires, picking a silly nickname or coming out with a weird logo or a weird promotional jersey, that's what they're going to do, and it's working.
Do you have any particular – we have a bunch of calls about to come in here, a flood tide of calls. The Hartford Flood Tide, also not on the list anywhere. But do you have any particular favorites, particularly from the world of minor league baseball, but anywhere else as well?
I love the Montgomery Biscuits.
Yeah, Montgomery Biscuits is great.
And they might have been the first one of this recent trend to push a silly name and try to make it somewhat serious and respectable. It helps. They lead in the merchandise charts, and that really helps with sales and revenue for the team.
Their team slogan is History in the Baking. And their team colors are butter and blue.
Right. And the logo is a biscuit with eyes and a big square of butter as a tongue.
See, I love that.
Yeah. How could you hate something like that?
Exactly. How could you hate a biscuit? Yeah. Dave, were you going to mention another one you like?
Well, just submitting my own name to this list,
yeah.
I went with the Huckleberries.
The Hartford Huckleberries, yeah.
Yeah, after Mark Twain.
Right.
I thought that made a great connection to the city of Hartford, and it seemed like something you could have a lot of fun with a brand, with a mascot.
It also, it spills off the tongue appealingly, the Hartford Huckleberries,
Yeah, some alliteration in there.
Yeah. And also, it's rhythmic, too, Hard for Huckleberries.
Right.
I like it as well. We're talking to Chris Creamer right now, and he is you wouldn't be willing to tell us how you got this list, right? I mean, you got this highly secret list of Hartford semifinalist names.
All you need to know is that it's accurate.
All right. Chelsea Manning, was it Chelsea Manning? you can tell us. All right, so we're going to go to the phones here, and let's start with Thea from Vernon. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Colin. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Great to talk to you. I had a favorite, and I think it harked back to Mark Twain, and it also brings a smile to people's faces.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of upset that it didn't make the list. I'm wondering if somehow I screwed up on my computer and I didn't hit the right button. It was the Hartford Humdingers.
The Hartford Humdingers.
And if you put humdinger in on the internet,
yeah,
the example of the youth, that was a humdinger of a storm.
Right. It's not that I don't like your name, but I feel as though Chris Creamer has kind of improved on it a little bit with the Hartford Huckleberries. Like, why wouldn't we want to be a Huckleberry instead of a humdinger, Thea?
I like Huckleberries, too.
Yeah.
But humdinger was what came to me.
All right.
The alliteration, the, you know, and the Mark Twain. 1904 was the first reported usage in print, which was Mark Twain's.
See, but that's like the Johnny Appleseed, Tim. It takes too much explaining to explain the connection. Although, Chris Creamer, you sort of like things that have to be explained a little bit.
Yeah, but I'm weird.
Yeah. Because I know there's one team called, I could find it here even, there's a minor league baseball team called the Keys, and it turns out that they're not named after Keys. There's no particular key-making factory there. It's that Francis Scott Key is buried very near the stadium, although I can't find it now. Do you know off the top of your head which one that is? It's a minor league baseball team?
I don't know. Yeah.
They're called the Keys. Francis Scott Key is sort of from the area, so they kind of, you know, already kind of own the national anthem, which seems like a quite an advantage for any sports team. It's the Frederick Keys, Orioles affiliate, single A, Carolina League. The Keys take their name from the famous poet and former Frederick County resident Francis Scott Key, who wrote the Star Spangled Banner. He's buried right near the Keys ballpark. Fans sometimes jingle their car keys in unison at Keys games. See, the one thing that has been suggested by Greg Hill here at our show is the good thing about the Yard Goats is, first of all, you'd have a fun noise you could make if you're sitting in the stands. And, you know, if we were, like, approaching the playoffs, people could grow their goatees.
Brilliant. Think of the marketing side of that.
Right. So that's the argument for the Yard Goats. The argument against them is no geographic connection. All right, here's Gail in East Granby. Hi, Gail.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
So my dad and I actually submitted a name, and I don't know, I didn't see the list, so I don't know if it's on it.
It's not.
It's not, okay. The Hartford Darts.
Hartford Darts.
But I was thinking of, you know, a way to connect. I like the idea of connecting Hartford's history
right
with this, but when I started going over some of the thoughts of what those might be, I think it points to why Hartford has such an image problem. We're known for, you know, the wiffle ball. We can't, you know, the Hartford Wiffles. No, I don't
think so. That's actually, it's New Haven anyway, I think.
Right. You know, and Hartford Bikes, Hartford Bicycles. No, that doesn't work, you know. Hartford Colts.
Hartford Colts, Hartford Popes.
I don't think so. You know, the gun thing.
Insurance-related.
I don't know.
Well, yeah, somebody actually, Chris Creamer, you just said insurance-related. Somebody Rob has just tweeted, what about the Hartford Actuaries?
Or the deductibles.
Oh, the Hartford you're good at this, aren't you? The Hartford deductibles.
I've been doing it all my life.
Well, this, you know, we have a lot more calls and we'll get to them. But the reason we have a lot of calls, I think, is because I assume, Chris Creamer, it's become commonplace to involve the potential fans somehow in this naming process to get that
right.
Buy-in.
Yeah. Maybe the last, going back to the 70s or so, you have had teams having a name the team contest involving the fans, you know, picking a list of finalists like we're doing right now with Hartford.
Mm-hmm.
It's just sort of a way to give the community some sort of ownership over the name, to make them feel like, you know, they've played a part in this brand that they're all being asked to buy into and fall in love with for the rest of their lives.
Larry is tweeting to us, years ago there was a minor league hockey team from Georgia, the Macon Whoopies.
Yeah.
And that is great. That's inspired.
Again, something you can only do in the minor leagues.
True. And I think also the only question that I have about the Macon Whoopies, although I'm in love with it, I'm completely in love with it, is something that's a pun. you might get, or something along those lines, you might get tired of that, right? I mean, the joy could possibly, after 2 or 3 years, the
right.
fact that this was very amusing the first time you heard it. There has to be durability here. You have to be willing to live with this name forever.
Right.
Yeah, I'm wondering. All right, so
To go on with that, you know, usually the first time you hear the new name of a team that you know, represents your hometown, you're almost always going to hate it. Looking back in the archives at different teams being named, the reaction from the public is always, I hate it. Why didn't they pick this? You know, no one's ever going to call them that. One example, for the Toronto Blue Jays, everyone wanted them to name the team the Blues.
Mm.
They hated the name Blue Jays. In fact, one local politician was quoted as saying, you know, no one's ever going to call them the Jays. Everyone's going to call them the Blues. You know, they'll just ignore it after a few years. But then you fast forward about 25 years, that politician is now the president of the Toronto Blue Jays. And the first thing he does is try to change the name.
Yeah.
But not to the Blues, but to the Jays.
Uh-huh. The thing he said that they would never do. Well, so
they almost did it.
Yeah. Well, as somebody, okay, so you're not that person here in Hartford, right? You're not the person who lives in Hartford and hates the name the first time you hear it. You're somebody who studies this, who knows as much as possible about this subject.
Right.
So as
right.
you run your eye down the list, Hartford Blue Frogs, Hartford Choppers, Hedgehogs, Honey Badgers, Hound Dogs, Praying Mantis, River Hogs, Screech Owls, Whirly Birds, Yard Goats. Do these all strike you as kind of stupid names, given the fact that you have no particular reason to reject them? You're not from Hartford?
There are some stupid names in there. Anytime you can take, like, for example, you could take any of the nouns in those names and, you know, swap them around with any of the descriptions of those nouns.
Right.
And they would still apply. You know, you could have the Hartford Blue Goats, the Yard Frogs, the Screech Pogs, you know what I mean?
Yes.
The Hound Owls, whatever. You can just sort of mix them all up, and you're going to get, you know, similar names.
Right.
They're going to make just as much sense. So for me, that's really a lack of creativity, the fact that you can apply anything to anything and call it a name.
Right. So we could have the Hartford Praying Goats, which I like that. Yeah. I will say one thing, and this would not be obvious to a person from out of town. But the Hartford River Hogs does sort of jump out as something a little bit better in the sense that Hartford's main river was the Hog River for a long time.
Okay.
Then it got changed to the Park River. Then it got put underground. It's not a glorious, happy story, really. It's now an underground river full of screaming rats. But you know, at least there is some kind of local connection. Actually, the screaming rats is not a bad name.
And you're getting good at this too,
right? And then, and then there actually is such. I thought there was no such thing as a river hog. I thought it was like another one of these, you know, rock cat kinds of things. But it turns out there is an African animal called the Red River Hog. It's really ugly, but it's there. All right, so let's. We've got some more calls coming in here. Wow, there's so many calls. I don't know how to pick. Okay, we'll go to Jason in Simsbury. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Colin, thanks for taking my call.
No problem.
Yeah, so I'm really disappointed with the proposed list of top 10 that have come out, like many of your callers and folks online. I had pitched the Hartford Hitmen.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one that I thought would be more evocative. And, you know, obviously it has a bit of a violent side to it. But I also think for a baseball team to suggest that they're all a lineup of really strong hitters is actually pretty clever, if I do say so myself. I want to do a write-in campaign or something to fix this discrepancy from the top 10 that has been proposed.
All right. Well, I'll throw it to the expert here. Chris Creamer, how do you feel about Hartford Hitmen?
A little violent, considering minor leagues, tend to focus on family-friendly images. I like Hitmen. There's a minor league team up in Canada called the Calgary Hitmen. And the alliteration plus it works with baseball.
Yeah.
But I just don't think it'll work in today's minor league.
Yeah, I think I got two problems with it. One of them is this stadium is going to be perched on the edge of an urban area that's had some, you know, pretty significant urban troubles and problems with violence and stuff like that. So, you know, and you sort of think about the way certain kinds of groups, including gangs, sometimes get into sports jerseys. You really don't want guys walking around with Hartford Hitmen jerseys on. And in terms of just merchandising, you know, if you're going to take your 8-year-old daughter to the baseball game, is she really going to want Hartford Hitmen. I mean, it seems to me if you could go gender neutral, you're probably, you know, opening up a whole marketing avenue that you don't want to close off.
Well, we've had an issue in the past with the Washington Bullets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Washington Bullets. Definitely a problem. That's why they're the Wizards now. All right, so let's go to Harry in Watertown. Hi, Harry.
Carrie.
Oh, Carrie. Sorry about that.
Yeah. To give credit or blame where it's due, Tom Condon was telling me about a basketball team in Hartford, which was known as the Hartford Fighting Actuaries, which kind of ties into the insurance history of it.
That would be something that Tom Condon made up, or that I made up. Or something. It sounds like something that either he or I made up.
Yeah, probably.
But the misconception there is that if you put fighting in front of something, it could possibly work. I don't think that that's the case. All right, we've got a bunch more calls here. And this so far, though, Chris Kramer, I have to say, and I'm not sucking up to you because you're the guest, but Hartford Huckleberry strikes me as a better name than anything I've heard. And Hartford Deductibles is not bad either. So.
Well, they're free to have either of them if they want them.
Or you're not going to, like, produce this audio later and start screaming about royalties.
It depends on how much money they make, I guess.
All right, because our next segment is about an incident in which the image of Mother Teresa may or may not have been copyrighted. So we're a little sensitive about that right now here in Connecticut. All right, let me take one more call. Betsy, how do you feel about that? One more call? Yeah, she says one, possibly even two, she says. All right, here's John in Middletown. Hi, John.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
How about the Hartford Harpooners?
Because of our whaling industry up here in Hartford. Well, so you're sort of building on the Hartford Whalers mystique, right?
Right, but not, you know.
But not. Well, you know, I mean, let me just go back to Chris Kramer on that. So, you know, you talked about how people don't like the name of a team when it's first proposed for their own vicinity, for their own hometown. And I have to say, when the Hartford Whalers were first introduced, I thought, isn't that kind of a discredited? It's like calling somebody the Pennsylvania Strip Miners or something. I mean, whaling, you know, itself is not really, you know, something that we're all that enthusiastic about right now. But on the other hand, the Hartford Whalers you know much more about this than I do, but I know of no defunct sports franchise whose paraphernalia, whose jerseys, whose logo has had the kind of durability. I mean, people really still like that whole thing.
Right. So, you know, the Harpooners, I don't remember the exact name, but that'd be great to buy into that, the Whalers market, not just in Hartford, but, you know, across the country. The Whalers, you know, very popular, even up here. I'm up in Canada, and I see Whaler stuff all over the place. The Montreal Expos is another example of a team that's as popular in terms of merchandise. But, you know, thinking back 20 years, you know, Whalers was a name that we all made fun of. The name, the logo, the uniforms, everything. And now we can't wait to have it back. We want to see it everywhere. We want to see teams wearing it. We want to buy it, wear it. That's just another example of, you know, over time, you get used to something, you fall in love with it, you form an emotional connection to it, and it's just part of the family.
I will say that I presided on stage over an incident about a few years ago in which the comedian John Hodgman professed his love of the Hartford Whalers logo and then was presented with a Whalers jersey and disrobed, at least from the waist up, on stage and put it on, which is maybe not even something that was called for. But one thing that I will just say while the world is listening is that once they pick this team and they start talking about the logo, they are fools, if they do not at least go and consult with Peter Good, who lives right here in Connecticut, who invented the Whalers logo, which is, I mean, one reason that Hodgman said he loves it is its use of what's called negative space.
Right.
That, you know, there's a way in which the negative space of the W creates the H. And so, I mean, to have this guy available and to farm this work out somewhere, I mean, maybe they'll wind up farming it out, but you know, in a way, Chris Kramer, logos are, that's like, we'll be having you back in 5 months, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, logos are a whole other set of conversations. Although I feel as though, and as we're wrapping this up here, I feel as though one of the things that happens that may lead teams in the direction of folly is that the people who pick the name start picturing the logo ahead of everything else. Like, I don't know why there are the New Britain Rock Cats or were the New Britain Rock Cats, but I feel as though they had like this idea of this really nifty logo, and they thought about that first before they thought about whether there was any such thing as a rock cat or whether there was any viable connection between rock cats and where they were. Do you want to comment on that?
You know, it happens sometimes, and it usually, results in failure.
Right. And broken hearts and the devastation of civilization.
There's one example, and that's the Oklahoma City Thunder, and they have an identity that's as bland as can be, in that their logo has absolutely nothing to do with their team name. They came out with the logo, and then they came out with the name a few months later, and right. You can tell they could have applied any name to that logo.
All right, I can't even picture the Oklahoma City logo. All I can picture
exactly.
is the face of Russell Westbrook. All right, so, well, Chris Creamer, now officially an investigative reporter into team franchise names, and before that, founder of SportsLogo.net. Thanks so much for joining us. We're going to take a break. We're going to shift focus a little bit. We're going to, what are you telling me? CT. Oh, yes, you're going to hear going out. I love it when I have to be prompted in the headphones because I've forgotten something that was told to me like 40 minutes ago. I have very bad short-term memory at this point. All right, so our friends at CT Improv, what they did was they tried to figure out what it would be like, because like the fans in the stands, right? So you want to have a cheer, basically. You want to make a noise, you want to have a sound. So they went through this list of the blue frogs, the choppers, the hedgehogs, the honey badgers, the hound dogs, the praying mantis, river hogs, screech owls, whirly birds, yard goats, and they tried lickety-split right on the spot to improvise some kind of cheer. Let's hear what they came up with as we go out.
Please welcome the Hartford Blue Frogs! Oh. Okay, please get it up for the Hartford Honey Badgers!
I don't care.
You don't give up.
You don't care.
I don't care.
All right, let me tell you about what's going to happen on the rest of the show. But first of all, I want to sort of slightly correct a one statement I made in the previous segment. I may have been incorrect in saying that the Park River is now an underground river full of screaming rats. I think it's more correct to say that it's full of wild, hungry, screaming rats. All right, so as the show goes on, at the end of the show today, we're going to take you metaphorically to a town called Farmington, New Hampshire, where they're doing something, the police department is doing something to make people really happy. We don't want to tell you quite yet what it is, but here in the dead of winter, in the bleak midwinter, there is, in fact, a happiness being almost kind of manufactured out of thin air in Farmington, New Hampshire. Before that, we unfortunately have to go to a slightly less happy situation, and that is in Trumbull, Connecticut, birthplace of our own Betsy Kaplan, producer of the show. But that's not the reason it's not. That would be a reason for them to be very happy there. But they're not that happy right now, and it all has to do with a painting, part of a series of paintings that was this one painting, part of this series of paintings, all on the walls of the Trumbull Library. But one painting in particular, these are all paintings by a painter named Robin Morris, excited criticism from one camp and got taken down by order of the first selectman of Trumbull. So here to explain this story much better than I am explaining it right now is Jane Resnick. She and her husband own this collection of paintings. They were the ones who made it available to the Trumbull Library, and they are the ones who have been rather disconcerted to see what's happened since then. So Jane Resnick, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you have this collection of paintings by this painter, Robin Morris, and the theme of this collection of paintings is Great Minds, right? Tell us about the collection.
Well, we started with a very large painting of Shakespeare, which we bought from Robin Lawrence, and then we began to think about an idea to continue it as a collection, and so mostly Robin and my husband began looking into scientists, philosophers, religious leaders, human rights leaders, people who we thought had really transformed the world by their work. Some of them are Albert Einstein, Isaac Newton, Mozart, Benjamin Franklin, and Jesus, now that we're getting to the religious part. And so altogether we have 33. We've hung them at Colgate University. It was for 6 months at the Quick Center at Fairfield University, and no one objected there. But now it's in the Trumbull Public Library, and I really was so pleased it was there because I felt the primary reason for it is education, and a lot of young people would get to see it. But we have heard from our first selectman that there was an objection to the painting by Pastor Gannon of St. Teresa's Church in Trumbull, and he removed it because he felt Mother Teresa appears in this painting and that it was an insult to her. We feel this is a trampling on our First Amendment freedom of speech rights as well as the separation of church and state. So when we pushed back and said, with the help of the librarian, that we would not take the painting down, we feel he concocted a reason. And that reason is that there's an organization that claims to own the rights to Mother Teresa's image, and it would be copyright infringement. However, we've seen no evidence of this yet.
I did a little research about this, and it does seem as though there's an organization in India that does hold, applied for and I believe got a copyright in India relating to Mother Teresa's name and image. And I think part of the problem was that in India, there even were, I think, banks and things like that that were calling themselves Mother Teresa Savings and Loan or something. So so that did happen, but I see no particular application of that copyright here in the United States. And it seems anyway as though this artistic use of Mother Teresa. We should say something about this painting in particular, all right? So you've got this painting of various kinds of women's advocates, right? I mean, it's a tableau kind of
right.
Fill in the
Whereas
tableau.
The
so
other
who's
paintings
that?
Are a single person. This is a tableau because it was so diffuse. The kind of when we looked into women's rights or women's issues, didn't want to pin down one because there seemed to be so many, and in a way we just wanted to sort of hold up inspirational figures, and we chose people like Mother Teresa and Clara Barton, Abigail Adams, Florence Nightingale, Gloria Steinem. These are people who have worked from the beginning about women's issues, and not even women's issues, helping the sick, you know, serving the poor as she did. There is no ideology in this painting. It's all about how these women have moved forward and really tried to make the world a more humane place. The painting is not about Mother Teresa, and it is not about what the pastor was really worried about, is abortion. Margaret Sanger is in the painting, and she was the first to try to help women plan family planning, and she worked to prevent backstreet abortions. The painting is not abortion, and it's not about birth control. So we don't feel that the painting can be taken down for this reason. It's a small part of the painting.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I think the painting has, at least for the moment, been taken down?
Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, Sue Horton, who's a librarian, and did a fantastic job of hanging these paintings. It is not easy. Some of them are 4 and 5 feet long, 3 feet high, and she worked so hard and was so really encouraged by the fact that she could bring something unusual to the library, was very reluctant to take it down, but Mr. Herb sent someone over and took it down.
Just to play advocate for the other side for a second. Well, first of all, I want to say that we did invite Tim Herbst, the first selectman of Trumbull, on today. He couldn't come. I mean, he literally couldn't come because of his schedule. He is willing and interested to talk about this. But can you understand or imagine another point of view here, and that other point of view being, well, if you're sort of this particular Catholic church in Trumbull, and there's Mother Teresa, and she's in a painting, and near her is a sign that says Planned Parenthood. Let's take Margaret Sanger out of the equation even for a moment. There's a sign that says Planned Parenthood. And you think, well, yeah, maybe they're trying to be inclusive and pluralistic, but they've got Our Mother Teresa next to the name of an organization that she just not only wouldn't be comfortable with, but would be, you know, extremely opposed to. Can you sort of, can you imagine that point of view?
Yes, I can imagine that point of view. But our point would be is if we allow a public official to find a way around the First Amendment, even if there is some legitimacy to that point of view, it's still not... It's still against our freedom of expression, and there's no reason why they wouldn't move against another arena. And if we allow a politician to inject religion into his actions, we're giving up one of our most important protections.
We've got a call coming in here, and so let me just, I'm going to put you on hold for just a second. And here's Howard calling from New York. I think I know which Howard this is.
Yes, you do, Colin.
Okay. So, Howard, this is Howard Sherman, right?
Yes, it is.
All right. So what's your purpose in chiming in here, Howard?
Well, my purpose in chiming in is this isn't an incident in isolation. I think we have to remember that there was also an incident of artistic censorship in Trumbull, Connecticut, now almost a year and a half ago, when the high school attempted to shut down a production of the school edition of Rent, because it had adult themes. In this case, the claim by the first selectman that this is a copyright issue and that he is in no way performing artistic censorship would seem to really be an attempt to split the issue and not get into content discussions. But I really want to go back to Mrs. Resnick. I may not have heard her while I was speaking to your producer, but it is my understanding that Mr. Herbst is saying, since there is no indemnification language, no agreement in which the Resnicks indemnify the town from any claims arising from the use or the display of the art, he is protecting the town. I subsequently saw a print report which said that Mr. Resnick has offered to indemnify the town. I'd love to confirm if that's true, because if it's true, indemnification language can be written in an hour. And therefore, if the town is not immediately making it possible for the Resnicks to indemnify and the town, and if indeed they're committed to doing so, then this proves there is something else at stake here.
Well, I, first of all, I'm not quite sure that we do have Jane Resnick here. So you and Dr. Resnick were told by the town, as Howard is saying, that if you could provide some kind of indemnification agreement which holds the town of Trumbull harmless against lawsuits that might arise from this use of Mother Teresa's image, which I regard as completely imaginary, but that then maybe the town would go forward. Tell us the status of that right now.
In fact, we did discuss this with the librarian because she said at the time, is the collection insured? What if something happens to the paintings while they're in the library? And we assured her at that time that we would not hold the town responsible for anything and that we would take full legal and financial responsibility for any damages. I don't believe we said any lawsuit because it never occurred to us. But it was informal and it was not written. So when he came up with this, my husband did try to speak to Mr. Herbst about it, but he was really not willing to stay on the phone with him. And we do think it would take about 10 minutes to draw up such a thing. The other point is that in making a statement, Mr. Herbst put the painting on the internet with his statement.
Yeah, it's on the town.
We feel
it's on
that
the town
he's
website.
Exposed us in a way that we would rather not have been in terms of anyone who might be out there would like to object now that we should hold us harmless.
Right. So they've kind of painted a bullseye on you guys by putting that thing up on the internet. So Howard, you're going
to on themselves, Colin, yeah. Because now they're putting the painting forward, even as they're claiming that the town would be at risk for displaying it. The town is displaying it.
Right. So my recollection, Howard, was that you were very interested and involved in the controversy and trouble over rent. How did that one wind up again?
The fact is, after 3 weeks, the show was restored, the show went on, and there was no complaint.
All right. Well, listen, we're going to have to pause it here, and we'll come back to this story if need be. Thanks very much to Jane Resnick, to Howard Sherman from Arts Integrity Initiative for calling in. When we come back, we're going to take you to a happier place, a place that is making sure that everybody's happy. That place is in New Hampshire. And, well, I'm not going to wreck it. I'm just not going to tell you what they do until you come back.
This would be the wrong time to mention my new Mother Teresa IPA, right? Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Our intern is Sydney Lauro. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Klinger. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff in their Beloit Snappers uniforms, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, the spiritual superiority of life in the North. And now, back to Colin.
Just for the record, there is a team called the Beloit Snappers in Beloit, Wisconsin. They are named after snapping turtles. And I believe the next town over is Turtle, Wisconsin. I'm not making that up either. All right, so we've been through a certain amount of stress about the upcoming name of our new baseball franchise here in Hartford. We've had a conversation about art in Trumbull and a town somewhat divided by that art. Now we're going to go to the happiest story that we have today. And when I saw this, I thought, you know, here in the bleak midwinter, we really are looking for things that make us happy. So imagine that you're in Farmington, New Hampshire, and suddenly you see a member of the Farmington, New Hampshire Police Department coming through you, towards you through the snow. Crunch, 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 his boots on the snow. And you think, uh-oh, I'm in trouble now. What did I do? Oh, look, he's got some kind of ticket book he's taking out or something. I'm so screwed. What's going to happen to me now? And then what happens? Well, I'm going to actually ask the chief of police in Farmington, New Hampshire, John Drury, to finish up that scenario for me. So these days in Farmington, New Hampshire, when I see that policeman coming towards me and taking something out of his pocket like he's about to write a ticket, what's the possibility? What's the alternative thing that might be about to happen to me?
Well, although we are on the lookout for violators, we are really trying to promote and look for the good that's out there. And so it very well may be that one of our officers is approaching you to give you a gift card for a slice of pizza or a small French fry.
I just love this. And I mean, are you at the point of having collected some reactions to this now? I mean, do you now sort of know what happens when you do that with somebody?
Yes, I actually was able to do this yesterday myself, and one of my sergeants today, and one of my sergeants last night, and one of my officers today, and the results have been a little bit of shock from the people that we're approaching, and it's been very good, and it's so nice to be able to thank you to people for doing things they do every day, and we have such great citizens in town. That it's just kind of nice to pay it forward just a little bit.
And the concept here is if you see somebody using the crosswalk properly or obeying the law in some other way, that's when you're going to, quote-unquote, cite them in this way?
That's correct. The officers will make every attempt they can to safely approach the person and thank them for doing whatever it is that the officer observed.
Whose idea was this?
It was actually mine. I could tell you a little story if you'd like as to kind of how it came about.
Sure, we'd love to hear a little story.
It was probably about 10 days ago or so. We were in the middle of winter and another snowstorm. I watched this gentleman walk down the sidewalk and use the crosswalk to go into a store and then come back out and retrace his steps back. And I said, that man deserves a medal for you know, for braving the snow and doing all this when he could have just cut across the street And I said, well, I can't give them a medal, so what else is there that we may be able to do for some, you know, these people that are really, really trying, and it's been such a tough winter, and we, you know, you have neighbors that are helping neighbors, and people are, you know, raking people's roofs and shoveling and all of this stuff that sometimes goes unnoticed, and although we'll never notice it all, maybe we can make a difference in a few things. And we've all been stuck indoors so very much. This is a good way for my officers to get out there, you know, make some nice contact, have a few minutes of small talk with somebody that they may not normally be able to talk to.
Now we're going to talk to the person they go to get the French fries or pizza from. But before that, since you mentioned roof raking, Chief Drury, I just quickly have to say, because I have to bring this up every time, Bill Curry borrowed my roof rake one time, broke my roof rake, didn't replace my roof rake, and the next time there was a big snowstorm about a year later, he called me up to ask if I'd gotten another roof rake so he could borrow it again. So please, if you stop somebody named Bill Curry, don't give him pizza or French fries or anything like that.
I think he might have committed a misdemeanor there for you.
In Farmington, New Hampshire, I totally believe you can be put in jail for something like that. But so Dan Crowley over at Crowley Market and Grill, are you the place that people wind up going after they've been written a ticket or a summons or a citation under this new program?
That is correct.
And how did you get involved in this?
Actually, when Chief Drury approached us last week with his idea and wanted to know if we wanted to partner up with him in this venture, we were very excited about it. So we put it all together last week and thought it was absolutely amazing idea, and just fortunate to be here and be part of the community here. It's an amazing thing he's doing, and it's a great group of people up here.
So have people come in yet to redeem their French fries and pizza police tickets?
Yeah, they have. There's been a few that have come in so far, and even ones that haven't. There's a lot of, obviously, publicity happening with this, and it's just it's a really positive thing. I mean, the things that we're hearing, it's exciting. After such a long winter that people are coming in with a positive attitude, and they're really impressed with what's going on here.
Chief Drury, how big a town is Farmington, New Hampshire?
There's about 7,000 people in town. We have 17 people in the department, of which 14 are sworn officers.
And Dan Crowley, I mean, I don't know, this is, I mean, not of 17,000 people, only a small number of them are going to get these tickets from the New Hampshire Police Department, from the Farmington, New Hampshire Police Department. But, I mean, are you sensing, I mean, is it cheering people up? I mean, this has been kind of a long, tough winter. Is it having any kind of ripple effect?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely the talk of the town. Everyone's talking about it. It's just an absolutely positive thing all the way around. It's amazing. You know, it's a sunny day out there today, but this is what everyone's talking about up here for the last couple of days, and it's just really positive, and it's warming. Everyone's happy inside, and it's had a great effect on this community.
I'm tempted to ask what else there is to talk about in Farmington, New Hampshire, but I'm sure there's plenty of other things. It's just simply not the case that this would be the only thing there would be to talk about. And so, Chief Drury, how long do you expect to see this, keep this going? Is this kind of a just sort of cheer up during the winter initiative, or how does it work?
Well, we kind of thought we'd give this a bit of a test run and try it for the month of March. It's gotten such good accolades over the past couple of days. I think it's something we probably should try doing again. It was it was just kind of something to kind of break the winter doldrums that we've had here, and you know, try and just spread a little cheer.
I think it even goes further than that. I mean, not to over glamorize it, but I mean, it is so much the case for those of us on the other end of this process that any time we see a policeman walking towards us in a very determined way, you know, we think, oh man, what did I do wrong? I did something wrong. I'm in trouble. So this idea that a policeman would be coming towards me to say thank you for obeying the law, and here's a ticket for some French fries or a slice of pizza or something. I mean, it really kind of it's not a little thing in some ways. I mean, first of all, what you really want as a police chief is for people to obey the law, not to have to go arrest people who aren't following it, right?
Oh, that's definitely correct. But you know, it leads me to another story of a gentleman that I had to arrest going back a decade or so ago, and nothing made me happier than, about 2 months later, he came up to me and he said, "Hey, thank you. What you did turned me around," and he showed me his first paycheck. So you never know when little things are going to maybe change somebody's life. And you know, a lot of us live and work in this area. We're obviously working for this town, and you know, it's not only we dealing with we're dealing with generations of people, and you know, it's a nice community.
It sounds like I want to move to Farmington, New Hampshire. At this point, it does sound really nice. Nice, Chief. We're pretty much out of time. In 5 seconds, what's the name of the team? Like the Farmington High School team? What are they?
We are the Tigers.
The Farmington High School Tigers. All right. See, that's a little bit more conventional. All right, we're gonna take a. We're not gonna take a break. We're gonna leave. We're done. Betsy Kaplan pulled this show together in 24 hours because she's amazing. Kyan Wolf's been on the board, reminding me of things that I forget. We'll be back tomorrow. We're doing Northmanship. It fits right into this New Hampshire story. The pride we take of living in the North.
And he's rounding second, third, and he's out. Another stunning defeat for the Hartford Busways.